Before we start, please note that this podcast features sexually explicit content and descriptions of violence and crime. Over a century ago, Lancaster was a wide-open city for prostitution, liquor, and gambling, otherwise known as vice. City officials tolerated and even encouraged these activities. Police knew where the brothels were, but instead of shutting them down, they socialized with sex workers. The mayor himself was known as a live wire, whose philosophy was live and let live. In fact, there were several well-known gambling games within a stone's throw of his office. That all started to change in 1913, when four detectives came from New York and Rhode Island to Lancaster for an undercover investigation of vice. They were from the American Vigilance Association, which was an organization dedicated to eliminating prostitution across the country. These investigators left behind their accounts of their travels through Lancaster hotel lobbies, alleys, bars, and brothels. They wrote detailed notes about their conversations with brothel keepers, who were also known as madams, waiters, sex workers, and bellboys. Their papers include 750 typed pages, photographs of sex workers and their houses, drawings of the layouts of brothels, and sex workers' calling cards. In addition, a local anti-vice agent who was not undercover kept copies of his handwritten notes about gambling, obscenity, commercial sex, and drinking in 10-bound books spanning 1913 to 1917. These typed reports and handwritten books make up the Vice Files. Our goal for each episode is to introduce you to a person we have encountered in these unpublished files. The Vice Files often reveal secrets that a person hid from public view, or simply details considered too trivial for news reports. But these details help us to reconstruct a person's struggles and motivations, and their sorrows and success. To us, these files are more than details about places and activities. They reveal people who wouldn't ordinarily make it into history books, or onto markers or monuments. It is worth getting to know them because they show how seemingly ordinary people navigated legal, political, and economic challenges, and how vice fit into people's everyday lives of work and play. Here's how each episode works. First, we present a profile of our featured person using public records, mainly newspapers from their lifetime, but also census records and court documents. The rest of the episode will focus on what the unpublished Vice Files say about the person. Meet Amanda Brenneman, notorious madam. This is what we know about her from public accounts. Amanda Hertzler was a white woman, born in 1854 in Manor Township. She married Adam K. Brenneman in 1874 at age 20 and had four children, William, Katie, Milton, and Charles, who died when he was four. The first time Amanda is mentioned in the newspaper is in 1901 when her son Milton died of typhoid fever. Brenneman would have been in her late 40s at the time, and the short article states that they were living on East Orange Street. Perhaps this put a strain on her marriage because by 1905, Amanda divorced Adam on grounds of desertion after 31 years of marriage. In 1912, she bought 39 North Water Street, a house in Lancaster's Red Light District. She then bought and lived in the next-door property, 41 North Water, and during February of 1914, rented out the rooms in that location. The property at 39 North Water became the brothel that made Amanda Brenneman notorious. But we learn little about this brothel in any published accounts until it was raided by police in 1914. The brothel operated in full view of law enforcement and with little interference from city officials. The friendly relationship between police and brothel keepers changed after the Law and Order Society published a report on vice in 1913. This report was based on the month-long investigation of four undercover detectives earlier that year. What was the Law and Order Society? It was a group of ministers, professors, doctors, and businessmen dedicated to getting rid of vice in Lancaster. It fought the corrupt city administration and the community's apathy. Remember, vice was not hidden. It was an open secret. The central figure in the Law and Order Society was Reverend Clifford Twombly. He was an outspoken opponent of the Republican administration, which was led by Mayor Frank McLean. Twombly argued that Christians should oppose political bosses, also known as the Republican machine, all the time, root and branch. The Law and Order Society supported the coalition of independent Republicans and Democrats, which increasingly challenged Republican rule in Lancaster. The Law and Order Society expose on vice was released in early 1914. This report was designed to embarrass the Republican administration and spur them to action. The shocking report claimed that the investigators had found about 190 sex workers at 53 different locations for prostitution, including both brothels and furnished rooming houses. It put pressure on Mayor McLean to act, but vice helped his political career and filled his pockets. So when the mayor pledged to clean up vice, observers were right to doubt him. Mayor McLean cast some doubt on the Law and Order Society's account by arguing that the number of brothels was not as great as the report indicated. He also claimed that closing down the brothels would not be effective because such action likely did not have the people's support. McLean's response is not surprising. In other cities, machine mayors who had benefited from the corruption surrounding vice approached reformers' demands reluctantly and deceptively. McLean announced in February that all brothels had 1 month to close. The crackdown began in May of 1914 when the police raided 6 brothels. In June, they closed 4 more. Yet, this was only 10 out of more than 50 listed in the report. Men and women who worked in these houses, along with some customers, were arrested and fined. Most, however, did not end up going to jail. In 1914 alone, there were multiple houses that were shut down twice. In some cases, madams and sex workers were released if they agreed to leave town. Prostitution did not end, however. Sex workers moved to other venues in the city, such as hotel side rooms, or they moved out of the city to nearby towns like Columbia or Marietta. The raid on Amanda Brenneman's house on Water Street was part of this crackdown. It was one step in putting the lid on vice, as one reporter put it. The Brenneman raid was unremarkable, except for the presence of one high-profile official, the chief of police, who descended on the house with 2 other officers late on a Saturday night in June of 1914. Another raid that occurred on the same night was much more remarkable. Reverend Clifford Twombly attended this raid. When the police swept through the first floor of Minnie Bristol's furnished rooming house on Fulton Street, they ignored the couple in the parlor. The pair ran out the door and down the alley on Fulton Street. Twombly himself chased and caught the man. In the midst of this chaos, Minnie Bristol had locked one officer in the dining room, forcing him to break down the door to escape. In the days following the raids, Brenneman walked into the Morning Journal to defend her name. She tried to convince the newspaper that she was an honest woman.
It's all spite work. A fellow who lives across the street is sore. He tipped the cops off. I'm an honest woman. I treat everybody right. Do I rent out rooms? Of course I rent one out now and then. A woman has to make her rent somehow. But I treat everybody on the level. And don't I have a right to hand out a little cake and ice cream when a friend and his friend drops in to see me? Yes, sirree, I'm an honest woman. Chief Bushong is a fine man, and I'm going to get square with that fellow who owes me $5 for doing his washing and now gets me into this mess. And if you don't print this, I'm going to push it after the hearing is over.
Despite her story to the Morning Journal, she pled guilty that September and was fined and sentenced to 3 months in jail. Only one other woman went to jail as part of this crackdown. She was Minnie Bristol, who was arrested on the same day as Brenneman. Newspapers reported that the women were surprised that they were not just fined and released. Their shock is understandable. Why were they punished so severely when police protected or ignored many others? The Vice Files give us some clues to explain Brenneman's plight. Let's open the Vice Files. Meet Amanda Brenneman, churchgoer, businesswoman, and repeat offender. When we open the Vice Files on Amanda Brenneman, we see how commercial sex infiltrated many sectors of Lancaster society, and we can see the full extent of her operation, which was much larger than the single brothel on North Water Street. But first, the files offer the only description we have of Mrs. Brenneman. Minerva Mullen, the only female investigator in Lancaster in 1913, described Brenneman as about 49 years of age, but in fact she was closer to 60. She had black hair and wore eyeglasses. She was 5 feet and 7 inches tall and weighed about 180 pounds. Mullen noted that she spoke broken English. Her parents likely spoke a German dialect known as Pennsylvania Dutch, which is from an area of southern Germany where most of the German settlers of Pennsylvania originated. Brenneman was a member of and a donor to the Reformed Church on Orange Street, which conducted services in German in the 19th century. Brenneman told Minerva Mullen that the minister of the Reformed Church was pleased to receive her donation. The minister wrote her a note of thanks, which Brenneman shared with Mullen.
My dear Mrs. Brenneman, I have called at your home twice to thank you for your generous donations. Will you kindly state to what use you want the money put, either for the church or for the poor? Thanking you, J.W. Menninger.
The investigator wondered if the minister knew exactly how she made her money. To this, Brenneman replied,
I have it plainly on the door. I don't try to hide it. Of course, ministers are like all grafters, take all they can get.
What exactly did Brenneman have posted on the front of her house? 41 North Water Street, her second property on this block, was a small two-story house with an awning over the doorway. A glass panel in the front door read, Mrs. Amanda M. Brenneman, Furnished Rooms. It would not be surprising for a woman, particularly a single mother, to rent out furnished rooms in the city. Many working-class women earned money taking in boarders in their homes, but renting furnished rooms could also be part of the commercial sex trade. Sex workers, known as inmates by the investigators, lived in brothels. They paid the madam half of their income in addition to room and board. They also paid for medical exams and any other service in the house, such as a maid or a cook. In return, the madam provided protection for the workers by screening out some undesirable clients. A furnished rooming house, on the other hand, was not a living space for sex workers. A prostitute who solicited on the streets could bring her client back to a furnished rooming house, such as Brenneman's place at 41 North Water Street. In addition to a room, these houses also provide cheap beer. Altogether, Brenneman owned 4 properties at this time. Her house at 213 West Avenue was a legitimate rental property. For her commercial sex business, in addition to her 2 houses on North Water Street, she also rented out a small bungalow on the banks of the Conestoga River, often called Brenneman's Bungalow. She gave Minerva Mullen a full description of her operations.
The bungalow down by the park I rent by the day and over Sunday to a crowd. It is not far to walk from the car to the end of Prospect Street, then cross over the bridge. I rent it for $2 over Sunday or $1 a day, to a couple, just 1 bedroom. This little place at 41 North Water Street, I have 2 bedrooms upstairs. I have no bath, but I put running water in the rooms. In the front room, I have a bed and a bed lounge where I have 2 couples together. They don't mind using 1 room, and then 1 bed in the back room. Then sometimes I rent my own room out. I get $1 for a little while, $2 all night, charge 50 cents a round downstairs for beer and 25 cents a bottle upstairs. I make steadily $35 to $50 per week.
Note that $50 in 1913 is equivalent to $1,500 today. Brenneman did not just provide beer and a bed. Her hospitality extended to the morning after. She offered the comfort of a warm cup of coffee to couples before they left in the morning. Brenneman's description offers useful clues to solve the mystery about why she was raided and punished harshly in 1914. She ran three different locations for commercial sex, the bungalow at Rocky Springs, plus two houses on Water Street. And she was known as a bad one for some of her practices, such as having couples double up in a room or allowing one man to have sex with two women at once. The Vice files show us even more about Brenneman. In particular, the unpublished papers show that prostitution had been part of her life for a long time, before and leading up to her divorce. Apparently, Adam Brenneman's involvement with prostitution was one of the reasons for their separation in the first place. Amanda Brenneman accused her husband of adultery and desertion in 1903. In the divorce proceeding, she complained about her husband's participation in prostitution. She claimed that her husband had a girl at Tilly Murr's brothel. Murr had been arrested several times for running a brothel and serving liquor without a license. After Brenneman's divorce trial, the judge granted her a divorce in 1905. Brenneman had been divorced for almost a decade by the time she conversed with the undercover investigators in 1913. It seemed that her husband still visited her furnished rooming house on Water Street for sex. She recalled that he brought sex workers to the house and contracted a sexually transmitted infection.
My husband comes here, buys beer, and takes a girl now and then upstairs. For a while I met him until he got a terrible disease, then I quit. But I might as well take his money as he will give it to strangers.
The Vice files reveal that Brenneman was pragmatic, resilient, and also defiant. In February of 1914, Chief Bouchon told Brenneman to close down her brothel and furnished rooming house. This is when the mayor announced that he was going to crack down on vice, after the Law and Order Society's sensational report was published. Brenneman, however, did not follow orders. For several months after Bouchon's visit with Brenneman, the Law and Order Society assigned an agent to spy on her from a house across the street at 32 North Water Street. The agent records a variety of suspicious visits to her house. 3 days after Bouchon's warning, the agent observed two men coming in from the side entrance and staying the night. She had beer delivered. Men and women came through the front and side doors in the early morning hours. 1 week before the arrest, the agent was watching Brenneman's houses from his hiding spot across the street. He noticed a particularly long list of visitors.
One couple left at 10:20 p.m. One couple left at 10:30 p.m. One man entered at 10:33 p.m. One man entered at 10:55 p.m. One man entered at 11:05 p.m. This man left at 11:35 p.m. This man entered by the alley, left the same way. One man entered by the front door at 11:38 p.m. This man was standing on the step when the man left by the alley. This man left at 12:25 a.m. going north on Water Street. Not seeing any more leave or enter, I left at 1:30 a.m., everything being quiet.
This revolving door of guests shows that her business was not quiet or secret. Brenneman did not hide. She sat in the front window and she sat on the front steps. She knew she was being watched. She dared the police to shut her down. Or perhaps she did not believe they would. 3 months after Bouchon's order, he arrested Brenneman. She posted bail and later served a 3-month sentence. Then she rented out 39 North Water Street to tenants outside of the sex trade. And at some point after these maneuvers, she moved to Columbia, Pennsylvania, as many other brothel keepers and sex workers did after the crackdown in Lancaster. She died there in 1917 at the age of 65 of pneumonia. She was buried in Lancaster's Riverview Memorial Park on South Duke Street. While drafting the script, we decided we wanted to find Amanda's gravestone. After looking around the memorial park for an hour on a hot summer day, we finally found it. It is a 4-part marble monument that had toppled into the grass. 2 marble stones make up the base, which is still intact. One tall column with her name and her daughter Katie's name had fallen off the base, and an ornate top piece was lying next to it on the ground. Although it was in disrepair when we located it, it is clear that it was once a grand monument. Before falling, the memorial would have reached a height of 5.5 feet, towering over the surrounding headstones. This monument, like Brenneman herself, would have attracted attention. It conveys defiance, pride, and affluence, not shame. The gravestone reminds us that she was not just a criminal caught up in the crackdown on vice. Rather, she was a successful businesswoman who overcame adversity through owning and operating multiple properties in Lancaster. Not all women working in vice experienced this trajectory. Most sex workers, for example, only spent 5 years in the trade and suffered from illness and violence. We are not trying to present vice as a lucrative business opportunity for women, but a few, like Amanda Brenneman, did succeed. When we saw her headstone in pieces, we made it our mission to try to fix it. After getting the cemetery's permission, we gathered a group together, both professional workers and supportive friends, to complete the project. With their help, we stabilized and leveled the base of the headstone. We had to use an array of tools, a drill, crowbars, and shovels, to get over 100 pounds of headstone back on. Although challenging, in the end, we succeeded in restoring Amanda Brenneman's gravestone to its rightful place. If you would like to learn more about the process and see photos, please visit our social media. This podcast was created by Allison Kibler and a team of students from Franklin and Marshall College: Jaden Lacoe, Kylie Lockney,
Rachel Rubens, and Dylan Sykes. Narration by Rachel Rubens. You can also learn more about these topics by taking the Lancaster Vice Walking Tour through the city.